Well, Matt, and welcome to episode 92 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 18th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we begin our two-month-long discussion of Twelfth Night with a plot synopsis and an intro of the play. To start off with, I'd like to apologize for any weird voice issues today. It's cold and flu season, and so I have a cold. All right. If you know the rough outline of the play's plot, you might assume that the Twelfth Night plot outline would begin with the shipwreck that strands Viola in Illyria. And some productions do begin with this, but you'd be wrong to make that assumption. Instead, we get a ridiculously lovesick Duke and one of the most famous opening lines in all of Shakespeare. If music be the food of love, play on. This unnamed Duke, we'll learn later, his name is Orsino, wax poetical on music, calls for more of it, and then just as abruptly calls for its end, as it is not so sweet now as it was before. He is so lovesick that when it is suggested that he go hunting to relieve his mind, he talks of Ovid's story of Actaeon, who is turned into a hart or a stag by Diana and killed by his own hunting hounds. Only here it's Olivia, we learn her name here, that has turned Orsino into the hart, and it's his own desires that are tormenting him. And why is he so lovesick and tormented? Well, like Romeo and before, it's unrequited love, baby. As we hear from a messenger, Olivia will spend the next 7 years mourning her brother's dead love. And as over the top as that seems, Orsino tops it. Oh, that she hath a heart of that fine frame to pay this debt of love but to a brother? How will she love when the rich golden shaft hath killed the flock of all affections else that live in her, when liver, brain and heart, these sovereign thrones are all supplied and filled, her sweet perfections with one self-king. And we're off, delusional, and running. In Act 1, Scene 2, we finally do see the results of the shipwreck. Viola enters, questions her ship captain as to where they are, and he provides Illyria. Her response takes the play from lovesick tinged with grief, Orsino's love is unrequited because Olivia has a lost brother, to seemingly full-on grief. My brother, he is an Elysium, the old Greek notion of a blessed afterlife or heaven. So Viola, too, has lost a brother, and we learn why. Drowning. But there is a glimmer of hope. Just as she survived, it's possible that her brother has survived as well, as the captain himself recounts seeing her brother bind himself to a strong mast that lived upon the sea. Then Captain Exposition, my name for him, not the play's, as he too is unnamed and will remain so, then provides more information. Illyria is ruled by noble Duke Orsino, a bachelor who, the last the captain heard, did seek the love of fair Olivia. Olivia is, the captain explains, a virtuous maid, the daughter of a count, that died some 12 months since, then leaving her in the protection of his son, her brother, who shortly also died, for whose dear love, they say, she hath abjured the sight and company of men. Now, Viola has found a kindred spirit in loss, and voices a desire to serve Olivia, but the captain nixes that quickly. Olivia, he says, will admit no kind of suit, no, not the Duke's. And here we get our first inkling of a classed society in Illyria. If Olivia won't even accept a messenger from the Duke, what hope does Viola have? Thus daunted, Viola sets her sights on serving the Duke. She asks that the captain help her disguise herself, conceal her what she is, present her to Duke Orsino as a eunuch, because she can sing and speak to him in many sorts of music. The plan seems logical. The ruse of being a castrated eunuch would be a good cover story for disguising Viola's voice, just as the men's clothes would disguise her figure. It's convenient, too, that we know that the Duke loves his music. Of course, Viola doesn't know this, but, you know, just go with it. The captain agrees, and we're off and still running. Act 1, Scene 3 takes us to the estate of Olivia, and we find her kinsman, Sir Toby, and her waiting gentlewoman, Mariah. Sir Toby is concerned about Olivia's mourning. What a plague means my niece to take the death of her brother thus? I'm sure care is an enemy to life. Mariah has no time for that subject and focuses instead on Toby's ill hours and the great exceptions Olivia takes to them. It seems that Toby's carousing and his bringing in a foolish knight to woo her are not going over so well. Toby tries to explain the virtues of the prospective wooer, Sir Andrew Aguecheek, citing his bravery, tall, riches, 3,000 ducats a year, and intelligence, speaks 3 or 4 languages. But Mariah sees him as a fool and a quarreler, but one who has the gift of a coward. Sir Andrew enters, and before her exit, there are exchanges that prove Mariah's categorization of Sir Andrew as a fool, and some that prove that both she and Sir Toby are not above sexually bawdy innuendo. Once she is gone, Sir Andrew announces his desire to return home, because he feels that Olivia will have none of him. The Count himself here hard by woos her. However, Toby is not convinced. She'll none of the Count. She'll not match above her degree, neither in estate, years, nor wit. I have heard her swear it. Tut, there's life in it, man. Again, we see examples of the classist society in Illyria. If Olivia had been truthful to Sir Toby, and Sir Toby is honest to himself, big if there, I know, Duke Orsino has no chance. The fourth scene of the first act takes us back to the court of Duke Orsino, where some 3 days have passed. And not only is Viola dressed as a man, taken on the name of Cesario, and situated into the Duke's entourage, but the Duke likes Cesario so much that he is like to be much advanced. Again, the class system at work. Orsino enters and immediately wants to talk to Cesario, to whom he says he has unclasped the book, even of his secret soul. Orsino wants Cesario to go to Olivia and be not denied access. Stand at her doors and tell them, there thy fixed foot shall grow till thou have audience. Cesario is to deliver Orsino's message of love, and success shall become Cesario well. Social advancement awaits. But why send Cesario? Orsino has sent older, more serious messengers, but to no avail. Orsino describes Cesario's appearance as, Diana's lip is not more smooth and rubious. Thy small pipe is as the maiden's organ, shrill and sound, and all semblative of a woman's part. Orsino seems to feel that maybe someone less threatening as a messenger may be more successful. But really, Orsino? Hello? Don't you get it? Cesario's a girl. Well, anyway, Orsino sends Cesario off, and Viola lets us know her true feelings. Whoe'er I woo, myself would be his wife. Viola loves Orsino. Any guesses where this is going? The fifth and final scene of Act 1 takes us back to Olivia's estate, where the scene begins, much like the earlier scene at the estate, with Mariah reprimanding one of the men of the house. In this case, it's Festy the Clown, who has been absent from the home and his entertaining duties, and Olivia is not happy about it. So much so that when Festy greets the Countess, she responds with, "Take the fool away." Festy then uses his foolish skills, and I mean that in a good way, to show Olivia the error of her foolish ways. Olivia's brother is in heaven, so if she mourns for him, then she's the fool. By the end of his dissertation, her respect for his skills overrides her earlier anger, and she asks her steward, "What do you think of this fool, Malvolio? Doth he not mend?" And now we meet a major player in the plot, the steward, Malvolio. When he insults the fool, she chastises him. "Oh, you are sick of self-love, Malvolio, and taste with a distempered appetite. To be generous, guiltless, and of free disposition is to take those things for bird bolts that you deem cannon bullets." Malvolio has a cruel streak, and it has not missed Olivia's attention. At this point, Mariah announces the arrival of a young gentleman who much desires to speak with Olivia. She guesses that he's from Orsino and sends Malvolio to tell the youth that she is sick or not at home. Malvolio re-enters, describing the messenger, who seems to have an answer to every statement Malvolio has made. not yet old enough for a man, nor young enough for a boy, as a squash is 'tis a peace cod, or a codling when it's almost an apple. 'Tis him in standing water between boy and man. He's very well favored, and he speaks very shrewishly. One would think his mother's milk were scarce out of him. It's quite the effeminate description. Maybe Orsino was right, however, in the earlier scene. Olivia announces that she will give the messenger audience. While the messenger is brought in, Olivia and her waiting gentlewoman don veils to hide their faces. Viola as Cesario enters and begins his speech, only to stop and ask which of the veiled women is the lady of the house, since he wants to direct it to the right woman, as it is excellently well penned and he has taken great pains to con it. Olivia admits her identity and so begins a wonderful game of linguistic cat and mouse, with Cesario hiding behind the part he is playing, Olivia trying to draw Cesario's message out into the open, all the while Viola teasing that she, as Cesario, is not what she plays, and that what she is and what she would are as secret as maidenhead. Cesario's words for Orsino don't succeed nearly as well as Cesario/Viola's own when Olivia asks what Cesario himself would do to convince Olivia of his love. Make me a willow cabin at your gate, and call upon thy soul within the house. Write loyal cantons of condemned love, and sing them loud even to the dead of night. Hallow your name to the reverberate hills, and make the babbling gossip of the air cry out, Olivia! Oh, you should not rest between the elements of air and earth, but you should pity me. To this, Olivia can only answer, you might do much. And from that point on, her tone and demeanor change. She asks of Cesario's parentage, sends him back to Orsino, never to return unless Cesario wants to return himself to tell her how Orsino takes the news. Calling Olivia fair cruelty, Cesario exits, leaving Olivia alone with her feelings. And what feelings they are. Just as Viola admits to us that she wishes to be Orsino's wife, Olivia wonders, how now? Ever so quickly may one catch the plague? Methinks I feel this youth's perfections with an invisible and subtle stealth creep into mine eyes. She sends her steward Malvolio to give Cesario back the ring he had brought from Orsino, even though no ring exists, and the one she does send comes from her own finger. She has fallen in love too, and she admits that she has no control. Fate, show thy force. Ourselves we do not own. But what decreed must be, and be this so. At the end of the first act, a woman has been shipwrecked, dons men's clothes and name, then falls in love with her new employer. Meanwhile, that employer, even as he sends his new servant to present his suit of love to a mourning countess, has quickly founded a heartfelt connection with this young man, who's actually a young woman. And while the countess has made every attempt to mourn and be melancholic, she also finds herself attracted to this young male messenger, not knowing that he's a she. And not one of them can control what they're feeling. Entering Act Two, we're now taken to an Illyrian lodging where we find Antonio and Sebastian, with the former pleading with the latter not to leave. Just as Olivia, seen earlier, said that fate had shown its force, Sebastian fears that staying with Antonio would adversely affect him because of the malignancy of Sebastian's fate. And just what's so bad about what's happened to Sebastian? Well, he tries to explain. Antonio, my name is Sebastian, which I called Rodrigo. My father was that Sebastian of Messaline, whom I know you have heard of. He left behind him myself and a sister, both born in an hour. If the heavens had been pleased, would they have so ended? But you, sir, altered that, for some hour before you took me from the breach of the sea, was my sister drowned. Sebastian had a twin sister, and while Antonio's ship saved Sebastian from the ocean, Sebastian's sister drowned. Interesting. Wait, you don't think, this couldn't be, maybe, nah, too coincidental. Of course his sister is Viola, but what I want to know is why did Sebastian take on the fake name of Rodrigo, especially as it doesn't play a role later, like Cesario playing a eunuch. Anyway, Sebastian bemoans his fate, telling Antonio that although his sister was accounted beautiful, it was also said that she much resembled Sebastian. Even that memory is too much, as Sebastian drowns her remembrance with more salt water, or tears, so much so that he admits that he is so near the manners of his mother. Not exactly cutting a macho image here, is he? Anyway, Antonio is willing to become Sebastian's servant to be with him, but Sebastian begs his leave, heading out to Count Orsino's court. Why? He doesn't say. But let's face facts, he has to, so that confusion and hopefully much wackiness will ensue. As Sebastian leaves, Antonio lets us know that even though he has many enemies in Orsino's court, Antonio so adores Sebastian that he will follow him. This feels like more than a mere bromance. Meanwhile, in Act 2, Scene 2, we're back to Olivia's estate, where Malvolio catches up with Cesario Viola and returns to the youth the ring Olivia had given Malvolio, which she claimed Cesario had given her as a token of love from Duke Orsino. Viola refuses the ring since she didn't leave one, but Malvolio ends up leaving the ring on the ground for Cesario to either take up or leave. Alone, Viola ponders the meaning of the exchange and comes to a realization. She made good view of me, indeed so much that methought her eyes lost her tongue, for she did speak in starts distractedly. She loves me, sure. Now, it sounds like delusion, but since we heard of Olivia's response with our own ears, Viola's right. Of course, now we've got a weird situation. My master loves her dearly, and I, poor monster, fond as much on him. And she, mistaken, seems to dote on me. What shall become of this? O time, thou must untangle this knot, I. It is too hard a knot for me to untie. Yeah, it's quite the quandary. But like Viola and Sebastian before her, Viola leaves it all up to time and fate. The third scene of Act 2 takes us back to Olivia's house, where Sir Toby and Sir Andrew are up late drinking. They're quickly joined by Festy the Clown, and within lines, music and singing fill the room. Mariah enters, complaining of their caterwauling, and warning that Olivia has called up her steward, Malvolio, and bid him turn them out of doors. Her warnings have no effect, and they continue to sing. Malvolio enters, and not surprisingly, reprimands the drunkards, first attempting to shame them, then speaking for Olivia. My lady bade me tell you that, although she harbors you as a kinsman, she nothing allied to your disorders. If you can separate yourself and your misdemeanors, you are welcome to the house. If not, and it would please you to take leave of her, she is very willing to bid you farewell. This, like Mariah's warnings before, have no effect, and despite Mariah trying to dissuade Sir Toby, he, Sir Andrew, and Festy continue their improvised song, deriding Malvolio. Sir Toby attacks Malvolio's position of steward, then calls for Mariah to give him more wine. Malvolio then turns his attack on Mariah. Mistress Mary, if you prized my lady's favor at anything more than contempt, you would not give means for this uncivil rule. She shall know of it by this hand. The language here and in the previous speech is interesting. With terms like disorders, misdemeanors, and uncivil rule, there is both pseudo-legalese at work here, as well as a subtle calling to mind the Lord of Misrule, a leader in the Feast of Fools and other rites of drunkenness associated with Saturnalia, which happens around Christmas time, as in Sir Toby's song snippet on the 12th day of December, which calls to mind the 12 days of Christmas, which leads up to the Epiphany, also known as Twelfth Night, the title of this play. But I digress. Malvolio leaves, and Mariah turns from exasperation toward the drunkards to anger at the steward, whom she describes as the devil a Puritan that he is, or anything constantly but a time-pleaser, an affectioned ass that cons state without book and utters it by great swaths, the great persuaded of himself, so crammed, as he thinks, with excellencies, that it is his grounds of faith that all that look on him love him, and on that vice in him will my revenge find notable cause to work. Mariah reveals her plan for revenge will be to write love notes that refer to Malvolio not by name, but by his characteristics. And since her handwriting looks exactly like Olivia's, Malvolio will believe that Olivia is in love with him. Much like Much Ado a few months ago, Twelfth Night's subplot will hinge upon a gulling scene. But here the intention is outright cruelty rather than teasing matchmaking. The fourth scene of Act 2 takes us back to the court of Orsino, where the Duke, as he did at the beginning of the play, calls for more music. And as they wait for Festy to arrive to sing, Orsino tells Cesario Viola if ever thou shalt love, in the sweet pangs of it remember me, for such as I am, all true lovers are, unstayed and skittish in all motions else, save in the constant image of the creature that is beloved. Now, if we thought Orsino was ridiculous back at the beginning of the play, this statement of being the quintessence of lovers doesn't back him away from the edge of ridicule. At least his self-centeredness isn't all-encompassing. He notes, Cesario's eye hath stayed on some favor that it loves. When Orsino asks Cesario of the woman he fancies, Viola begins another game of verbal cat and mouse, just as she had with Olivia earlier in the act. According to the Duke, a woman of Orsino's complexion is not worthy of Cesario, and a woman of Orsino's years is too old for the youth. Why? Because in Orsino's mind, the woman should take an elder to herself. Of course, this works out perfectly in the end when Orsino and Viola become a couple. Whoops, spoilers. Orsino advises the boy that men's fancies are more giddy and unfirm than women's are. Festi arrives, and we are treated to one of the most depressing love songs in Shakespeare, but perfect for the pining, unrequited Orsino, who loves it. And it prompts him to send Cesario back to Olivia to tell her that it isn't her lands or possessions he wants as part of some dowry, but rather her beauty, that miracle and queen of gems that nature pranks in her. Cesario asks what Orsino would do if Olivia cannot love him. He simply won't accept the answer. Cesario Viola, however, turns the table on him. Say that some lady, as perhaps there is, hath for your love as great a pang of heart as you have for Olivia. You cannot love her. You tell her so. Must she not then be answered? For Orsino, this is rhetorical, hypothetical. For Viola, reality in a test case. His response takes him back to the laughable self-centeredness of earlier in the scene. No woman can love like he does, as their hearts are not big enough to hold what he feels. He concludes, make no compare between that love a woman can bear me and that I owe Olivia. Now, for me, this would be the deal breaker, but Viola loves him, and I'm guessing with the same self-delusion as he loves or thinks he loves Olivia, and she begins to respond, I know, and then cuts herself off. My thinking here is that she fears revealing herself to him. This time, he presses the point, asking what Cesario knows, and she responds, too well what love women to men may owe. In faith, they are as true of heart as we. My father had a daughter, loved a man. As it might be, perhaps, were I a woman, I should your lordship. It's a wonderfully ironic speech, seemingly about a sister, but really about herself. She goes on to say how this sister never told her love, but let concealment eat away at her. This too, Cesario Viola argues, is love. When the helpless romantic asks if the sister died of her love, Viola uses her irony as a shield again. I am all the daughters of my father's house, and all the brothers too. And the Duke sends Cesario off with a jewel to Olivia and a message that he will not be denied. The last scene of Act Two is the gulling of Malvolio that was set up a couple of scenes earlier. Sir Toby, Sir Andrew, and another servant, Fabian, enter, complaining of the steward. Mariah arrives to announce the coming of Malvolio, and the threesome hides to watch. When Malvolio enters, he's musing to himself about how fated his relationship with Olivia is. Fortune will rule all, he says, and then lists the way Olivia has shown that she cares for him. He even flatters himself with the idea of marriage to the Countess, angering Sir Toby and Sir Andrew, with Fabian trying to quiet them. Malvolio's fantasy is quite elaborate. In it, he's dressed in a velvet gown, has just left Olivia on a daybed, a sofa as opposed to the nightbed, even his fantasies are chaste, and reprimanding Sir Toby, who has just about lost his mind. Malvolio's reverie is cut short, however, when he finds the hidden note. Now, this is a sequence that I'll most likely go into more detail later, both cleanly and bodily, so I won't want to delve too deeply here. But the letter is addressed to the unknown, beloved, this and my good wishes, and the writing on the outside matches his lady's hand, as Mariah predicted. He opens the seal and reads the poetic opening, the final line being, no man must know, and he makes the quick logical jump to ask himself, if this should be thee, Malvolio? The letter continues with the phrase, "I may command where I adore," which only emboldens Malvolio's delusion. The delusion reaches its comic epitome when Malvolio attempts to decipher the line, "M-O-A-I doth sway my life." Now, he sees his own name in the letters, M, obviously, and every one of these letters are in my name. With the delusion accepted as fact, Malvolio moves on to the prose portion of the letter. "Be not afraid of greatness," the letter continues. "Some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them." This feeds Malvolio's fantasy of not only having Olivia as his wife, but to achieve the relative greatness of her social stature. Remember all of that classist stuff from the first act? Well, it's back. The fates open their hands, and Malvolio must take them. The letter then outlines some specific acts that he must perform, including argue with a kinsman and wear yellow stockings cross-gartered. Do these things, the letter implies, and thou art made. Again, social advancement. But if he doesn't do these things, he will be a steward still, and the fellow of servants, and not worthy to touch fortune's fingers. The trap has been sprung. Malvolio is sure that Olivia loves him. He says that he will wash off gross acquaintance and do all that the letter commands. He thanks Jove's and Malvolio's stars or fate, and he goes off, ready to smile at Olivia as the postscript of the letter dictates. Sir Toby is so thrilled with the results that he tells Fabian that he could marry the wench for this device. When the wench Mariah returns, she fills in her three stooges on some inside information. Olivia abhors yellow, detests cross-gartering, and will find Malvolio's smiles unsuitable to her disposition, melancholy, and the merry band of pranksters exits to end Act 2. The beginning of Act 3 takes us back to Olivia's estate, where Cesario Viola has gone to deliver Orsino's jewel to the Countess. Cesario is greeted by Festi, and the scene begins with some witty banter and wordplay about, well, words, which may be made wanton by those who dally nicely with them. When the clown leaves to let Olivia know that Cesario is there, Viola muses on what wit is needed to play the fool, a practice as full of labor as a wise man's art. The juxtaposition between Festi and Viola's discussion of playing the fool, with the entrance of the two stooges, Sir Toby and Sir Andrew, is striking, and because of it we see just how witty and smart Viola is. Hot on the heels of the fools comes Olivia, who immediately sends them off for some private time with, and for the first time, Olivia asks Viola's name. That given, Olivia wants no more talk of Orsino in his suit. Instead, she desires Cesario to undertake another suit. She'd rather hear Orsino solicit that than music from the spheres. Olivia first admits to the subterfuge with the ring, and then asks, "I prithee, tell me what thou thinkst of me." Viola says, "That you do think you are not what you are." Viola responds, "If I think so, I think the same of you." Viola then responds, "Then think you right, I am not what I am." To which Olivia says, "I would you were as I would have you be." Lovely irony upon irony. Olivia confesses her love for Cesario, knowing that there is no cause but love, or as she puts it, love sought is good, but given unsought is better. Even when Viola leaves, saying that no woman will have her heart, only she herself alone, Olivia calls after him, "Yet come again." And just as Olivia calls for Cesario to return, at the beginning of Act 3, Scene 2, Fabian and Sir Toby call for Sir Andrew to stay. He wants to leave because he feels that he has no chance to win Olivia's hand, as he has seen Olivia do more favors to the Count's serving men than she ever bestowed upon him. The two others spin this as Olivia trying to make Sir Andrew jealous and to put fire in his heart and brimstone in his liver. They convince him to send a letter of challenge to Cesario, and he leaves to do so. The two then joke, comparing Sir Andrew to Cesario, who bears in his visage no great presage of cruelty. These jokes are interrupted by the arrival of Mariah, who wants to bring them to see the results of their gulling, Malvolio, in yellow stockings and cross-gartered. Act 3, Scene 3 takes us back to Sebastian and Antonio on a street in the Illyrian capital. Antonio followed Sebastian here, as the former's desire, more than sharp-filed steel, did spur Antonio forth, and his willing love set forth in Sebastian's pursuit. Sebastian wants to see the sights and monuments, the relics of this town, but Antonio is more interested in getting lodging. Why? Because Antonio does not, without danger, walk these streets. Once in a sea fight against the Count and his galleys, Antonio did some service. Antonio didn't kill anyone, the implication here is of piracy, what we took from them, but if caught here, he shall pay dear. Instead, Antonio gives Sebastian his purse in case his eye shall light upon some toy you have desire to purchase. And can't you just see that rearing its ugly head later? The fourth scene of Act 3 takes us back to Olivia's estate, where the Countess and Mariah enter. Even with her waiting gentlewoman, Mariah's words are an aside, not to be heard by Mariah. I have sent after him. He says he'll come. What shall I feast him? What bestow of him? For youth is bought more oft than begged or borrowed, I speak out loud. She's a middle school girl, waiting for her crush to show up at the lunchroom table. To cover this, she asks Mariah about Malvolio, who is sad and civil, and suits well for a servant with my fortunes. Here she reminds Mariah of how she has been feeling, serious and calm, as well as us, the audience, of how Malvolio has been regarded to up to this point. Mariah responds that Malvolio is on his way, but that he's changed. He does nothing but smile. Mariah is convinced that it's madness, but Olivia wants to see him. While Mariah is offstage getting the steward, Olivia states, I am as mad as he, if sad and merry madness equal be. She obviously doesn't believe Mariah's description of Malvolio, because there's absolutely no way Olivia could be describing as sad her own actions of late. Nope, Olivia has the merry madness of love. Malvolio enters, and Olivia's words give the actor playing Malvolio direction as to how to play it. Smilest thou? I sent for thee upon a sad occasion. And if the audience isn't at least smiling, if not out and out laughing over the course of the next 40 lines, something is very wrong with either the audience or the production. He's in yellow, cross-gartered, smiling constantly, tossing double entendres Olivia's way, reciting by memory portions of the letter, over the top, ridiculous, hilarious. Of course, if I was Olivia, I'd be more than a little freaked out. So, needless to say, when word comes that Cesario has arrived, she takes no pause to leave the scene, though she does tell Mariah to let this fellow, Malvolio, be looked to. With Olivia gone to see Cesario, and Mariah off to get Sir Toby, Malvolio happily reviews how well the encounter has gone in his mind. He is sure that nothing can come between him and the full prospect of his hopes. Now he just has to be opposite with a kinsman, Sir Toby. But he doesn't get much of a chance to, as Mariah, Sir Toby, and Fabian all verbally accost him with accusations of demonic possession. He leaves them just as he might wash off gross acquaintance off his back, saying to them, "You are idle, shallow things. I am not of your element." They decide to capture him, bind him, and throw him into a dark room, and there torment Malvolio for their pleasure and his penance. This does not sound like fun. What is fun, however, is when Sir Andrew arrives with his letter of challenge for Cesario. Milquetoast would be overstating its strength. Sir Toby says that he will deliver the letter and tells Sir Andrew to ready himself to draw on Cesario when next he sees him. Sir Andrew exits, and when he's gone, Sir Toby says that he will not deliver the letter because it won't scare Cesario. Instead, he will orally deliver the message so that both will be so afraid that they will kill one another by look, like cockatrices. They leave to afford Olivia and Cesario some privacy as the two enter, with Olivia calling Cesario's a heart of stone, and Cesario still pleading his master's suit. Even in defeat, though, the Countess cannot say goodbye. Well, come again tomorrow, fare thee well, a fiend like thee might bear my soul to hell. With Olivia gone, Sir Toby and Fabian return to warn Cesario of the impending fight with the quick, skillful, and deadly Sir Andrew. Cesario, Viola, fears this because she is no fighter, saying that any offense taken by Sir Andrew was by Cesario's negligence and not by his purpose. Sir Toby retrieves Sir Andrew, and when the four are brought together, both combatants are so filled with fear that while there is a drawing of swords, there is no fight. And then Antonio arrives. He sees an effeminate young man looking like nothing but the Sebastian he had just left in town. He loves Sebastian, so he enters the fray, saying, "Put up your sword. If this young gentleman hath done offense, I take the fault on me. If you offend him, I for him defy you." Sir Toby, his fun ruined, draws on Antonio, but it's all broken up by a number of officers who rush the stage. They arrest Antonio, whom they recognize even with no C-cap on his head. He asks Cesario, who he thinks is Sebastian, for the purse of money so that he can pay any fine or penalty. Cesario doesn't give him the purse, because he doesn't have it since she's not Sebastian, but does offer to give him half his money out of his lean and low ability. Antonio is upset with this betrayal in the face of these kindnesses that he has done. He complains to the officers about how he had snatched this young man out of the jaws of death, and as he is being led away, accuses Cesario, "Thou hast, Sebastian, done good feature shame." While Sir Toby still spoils for a fight between Cesario and Sir Andrew, Viola is lost in thought. Methinks his words do from such passions fly that he believes himself, so do not I. Prove true, imagination, oh, prove true that I, dear brother, be now attained for you. He named Sebastian. I, my brother, know, yet living in my glass. Even such and so in favor was my brother, and he went still in this fashion, color, ornament, for him I imitate. Oh, if it prove, tempests are kind, and salt waves freshen love. Could it be? Could the long-lost brother not be lost at all? Viola runs off. Sir Toby and Fabian tell Sir Andrew that this is proof of Cesario's cowardice and that he should follow him. And with that exit, so ends Act 3. Act 4 begins at Olivia's estate, where Festi and the clown meet who he thinks is Cesario. Only it's not. It's Sebastian. And he wants nothing to do with the clown, to which Festi can only list the things that he knows to be true, concluding, "Nothing that is so." The irony is that nothing is what it seems at this point. Sebastian even tries to bribe Festi into leaving him alone, using the money Antonio tried to get returned from Cesario. When Sir Andrew enters and strikes Sebastian, thinking he's Cesario, Sebastian strikes him back and says, "Are all the people mad?" A legitimate question. Sir Toby tries to restrain Sebastian. Festi exits to tell Olivia. Sebastian breaks free and draws on Sir Toby, who draws in return. Then Olivia enters. She reprimands Sir Toby and sends him away, out of my sight, and then turns towards Sebastian, telling him, "Be not offended, Cesario." She implores for him to go with her to her home. Sebastian turns from wondering if all the people are mad to questioning himself. "Or I am mad, or else this is a dream. If this be a dream, still let me sleep." He goes along with the dream and leaves with Olivia. Act 4, Scene 2 takes us into Olivia's house, to a room where Malvolio is being kept and tormented. Mariah has Festi dressed like Sir Topas, the curate, a clergyman. There's a cynical moment when Festi says, "Well, I'll put it on, and I will dissemble myself in it. And I would I were the first that ever dissembled in such a gown." He wishes that he would be only the first one who has ever lied while in the garb of a pastor, but he, and by implication we, know that isn't true. When Sir Topas appears before Malvolio, the steward is grateful and calls for the curate to go to Olivia, his lady. But Sir Topas turns this request into something unsavory, calling him a fiend and asking, "Talkest thou nothing of ladies?" Malvolio claims that he is not mad, insane, but rather has been wronged and is being kept in darkness. Sir Topas responds by calling him dishonest Satan. Malvolio continues to proclaim his sanity and says that he can prove it, as Sir Topas will ask him any constant question. Instead, Sir Topas twists and contorts all of Malvolio's words against him. Sir Toby pulls Festi aside and tells him, "I wish we were well rid of this knavery. If he may be conveniently delivered, I would he were, for I am now so far in offense with my niece that I cannot pursue with any safety the sport, the upshot." And this, if it wasn't already dark, is where it gets really dark. Sir Toby wants to get rid of Malvolio, since they have crossed the point of no return with Olivia, and Sir Toby cannot see any safe outcome. When Festi, this time as his self, returns to Malvolio, the steward, still lucid, attempts to persuade the clown to allow him to write a letter to Olivia. Malvolio knows what kind of world this is, one of social classes, one where he may be propertied by another. For taking the letter to Olivia, Malvolio will requite it in the highest degree, and for the pen and paper to begin the process, it will advantage him more than ever the bearing of the letter did. Malvolio offers social advancement. In the short last scene of Act 4, Sebastian ponders his fate. He knows some things. This is the heir. that is the glorious sun, 'tis not madness. Yet either he is mad, or else the lady's mad. His rationale for her sanity is interesting, however. If she was insane, she could not sway her house, command her followers. In his thinking, she must be sane because she's in charge. And how in charge? Just a few lines later, she enters with the priest. And just as quickly, Sebastian and Olivia are off to be married. And we are off to the final act and scene. The fifth and final act of the play takes place at Olivia's estate, with Fabian asking Festi to see the letter from Malvolio. Duke Orsino and his entourage, including Cesario, arrive to speak with Olivia. After a little witty banter between Orsino and Festi, the officers come to the Duke with their prisoner, Antonio. Orsino recognizes him immediately and magnanimously remembers that very envy and tongue of loss cried fame and honor upon him. Cesario commends Antonio to Orsino, recounting how Antonio had drawn on his behalf. After Orsino asks the pirate and thief why he has come to Illyria, Antonio refuses those monikers, accepts that of Antonio's enemy, and says that it was witchcraft in the form of that most ingrateful boy. He then goes over how he had given over his purse, but then was refused when he asked for it back for his bail. It's at this point that Orsino asks one of the first intelligent questions of the play. When did you come to town? Antonio tells the truth. Today, my lord, and for 3 months before, no interim, not a minute's vacancy, both day and night, did we keep company. Orsino says Orsino's words are madness, since Cesario has been with Orsino these past 3 months, and this should begin to solve all the problems, except that in one of the greatest examples of distraction in theatrical history, Olivia arrives, and any train of thought Orsino had is derailed. Olivia immediately wants to know why Cesario isn't with her. When it becomes obvious that Olivia only wants Cesario, Orsino's mood turns. But this, your Minium, whom I know you love, and whom, by heaven, I swear I tender dearly, him will I tear out of that cruel eye where he sits crowned in his master's spite. Come, boy, with me, my thoughts are ripe in mischief. Now there's some twisted stalker logic for you. If I can't have you, you can't have him, even though I love him too. The scary part is that Viola is apt and willing to die. Viola then reveals that she loves Orsino more than she loves these eyes, more than her life. Betrayed, Olivia calls out, Cesario, husband, stay!
Husband?
Olivia calls forth the priest, and he tells the assembled how he married Olivia and this young man just 2 hours ago. Orsino doesn't want to kill Cesario anymore, but he doesn't want to see him again either. O thou dissembling cub, what will thou be when time has sowed a grizzle on thy case? Or will not else thy craft so quickly grow that thine own trip shall be thine overthrow? Farewell and take her, but direct thy feet where thou and I henceforth may never meet. Enter Sir Andrew, claiming that he has had his head broken across by Cesario, and that the young man has given Sir Toby a bloody coxcomb too. Viola, of course, denies this even when Sir Toby comes and goes. Then Sebastian enters, apologizing to Olivia for hurting her kinsman. The Duke looks over at Sebastian and says, one face, one voice, one habit, and two persons. Sebastian sees Antonio and greets him happily. When Antonio asks Sebastian if he is Sebastian, the no longer long-lost brother says, fearest thou that, Antonio? Antonio is confused. Olivia is full of wonder, most wonderful, and we get the reunion we've been hoping for since Act 1, Scene 2. Questions are posed and answered, proof asked for and received, and identities are revealed. Sebastian jokes to Olivia that she would have been contracted to a maid. Orsino remembers that as Cesario, Viola swore that she would never love a woman like to the Duke. Viola says that she will those swearings as true in soul. Orsino then says that he cannot wait to see Viola in her women's clothes. And they lived happily ever after, laughter, swell music, drop curtain. You could, I guess, end the play there, like they butchered King Lear by ending that play with the reunion of Lear and Cordelia. But that sort of shortchange would feel wrong here as well. Instead, Viola brings us and the play back to reality. Her garments are with the sea captain, who is now in custody due to a legal proceeding by Malvolio. Ah, yes, Malvolio. Olivia remembers his distraction and confinement, and she calls for him to be enlarged or freed. While they get the not mad madman, Festi reveals the letter that he wrote for Malvolio to Olivia, one that recounts the steward's side of the story and how he's been madly used. Olivia tells Orsino that though she may not be his wife, she will be his sister. She also announces that she'll pay for the wedding costs herself. Orsino then tells Viola that he releases her from being her master's servant to, if she should choose, to be her master's mistress. Malvolio is brought in, railing on how Olivia has wronged him. He shows her the letter he thinks is from her and asks, "Why have you suffered me to be imprisoned, kept in a dark house, visited by the priest, and made the most notorious geck and gull that error, invention played upon? Tell me why." Olivia breaks the news as gently as possible, but the truth is the truth. This is not Olivia's writing. She tells him that when they know who the authors are, Malvolio shalt be both plaintiff and the judge. The authors are revealed by Fabian, who tells of Sir Toby's marriage to Mariah in recompense of the jest. And he calls the whole endeavor a sportful malice, which may pluck on laughter than revenge. Laughter, however, is not in the cards, as Malvolio says as he exits, "I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you." Orsino calls for someone to bring Malvolio back so that they can get Viola's clothes from the sea captain. Until then, Viola will remain Cesario, but when, in other habits, Viola is seen, she will be Orsino's mistress and his fancy's queen. They all leave the stage, leaving only Festi for one last song, one that says that our play is done. So, Twelfth Night. This is the last of Shakespeare's great comedies. From here on out, it's tragedy, dark comedies, or problem plays, and tragicomedies, or romances. We get many of the tropes of earlier comedies: twins, mistaken identities, women disguised as men, mismatched lovers, journey, or in this case, shipwrecked into a new land, clowns, and songs. Think of this as a culmination, a greatest hits package, a big-ass package of fun wrapped in yellow and cross-gartered. So let's have some fun for the next 2 months. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries these past couple of weeks, you've missed out on subjects including a new year, a new month, a new play, Twelfth Night, Twelfth Night sources, plot summary Act 1, Scenes 1 through 4, Lost Brothers, Lovers Never Had, and A Bromance Is Kindled, plot summary Act 1, Scene 5, Clowns, Drunkards, Cruel Self-Lovers, and Quickly Catching Plagues, plot summary Act 2, Scenes 1 through 3, Brother Lost No More, A Realization, and A Crackdown on Uncivil Rule Leads to a Scheme, plot summary Act 2, Scenes 4 and 5, A Pure Philosophical Discussion on the Genders, and A Gulling of a Puritan. Plot summary Act 3, Scenes 1 through 3, more and even more cat and mouse, plus When the Twin Comes to Town. Plot summary Act 3, Scene 4, cross-gartered and painful. Plot summary Act 4, much wackiness and cruelty ensues. And plot summary Act 5, it's all happening, including threats of revenge. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just one daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page or our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. Been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 18th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. and we shall see thee anon.